Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. Welcome to all of you early risers. Continuing our theme of resilience, the title of Lori's sermon next week is...
Excuse me, Pastor Carpal Zimmer. We have an interruption to this broadcast for a very important announcement.
Good morning, viewers. Christy, do you realize that this is the only local venue that brings religious programming to the Northeast Ohio area that is free of advertisements and doctrine?
That's right, Brad. And further, our audience has a say in our programming.
To maintain the quality programming that you've come to expect, we conduct an annual pledge drive, which is now underway.
Brad, did you know that it takes over 50 people and a great deal of time and money to support our outstanding musical ministry?
That's right, Christy, and to give our audience just a sampling of the extensive quality musical programming that we have to offer, take a look at this.
We welcome you this day.
In order to bring you more of this exceptional music, operators are standing by downstairs to accept your pledge.
And as an added bonus, the first 50 donors to pledge $5,000 or more will receive a free CD of live performances by our own Hal Walker.
And today, donors will receive a sweet treat downstairs. Thanks for your generosity. We now return you to our regularly scheduled program.
Symbol of our free faith, may this flame kindle in us a reminder of the fire of commitment, the light of love, and the warmth of community.
Our call to worship this morning is a piece by Libby D. Stoddard. We have come into this room of hope where our hearts and minds are opened to the future. We have come into this room of justice, where we set aside our fear to name freely every oppression. We have come into this room of love, where we know that no lives are insignificant. We have come into this room of song, where we unite our voices in both the somber and the beautiful melodies of life. Come. Let us sing. Come, let us worship together.
This morning we are remembering and honoring what happened in Selma, Alabama, 50 years ago, during the time of the civil rights movement in the United States. Back then, Selma was segregated, racially segregated. That means that they had laws against black and white people going to the same restaurants or using the same bathrooms and water fountains or even attending the same schools. Black people in Selma lived on one side of town and white people lived on the other, and the two were separated by a bridge. Most of the black people were poor, and most of the white people had much more money. Unlike the white people, the black people had no running water or flush toilets, and their roads were made of dirt. Their children went to run-down schools, and there was little that they could do about it. A big reason for that was because they couldn't vote. More than half of the people in Selma at that time were black, but only 1% were registered to vote. They lived in the greatest democracy in the world, but they couldn't vote for the leaders that would help them improve their living conditions. To vote, they would have to pay a poll tax, and they would need to pass a written test that they couldn't pass. In fact, the test was designed to be impossible to pass. Martin Luther King Jr. was a Baptist minister who came to Selma to help. Since they couldn't vote, he suggested another way, to join together and march to the Capitol, Montgomery, Alabama, to ask the governor for help. To march to Montgomery was truly frightening. Not only was Montgomery 54 miles away, but the highway went right through Ku Klux Klan country, through people who hated blacks, white people with guns and whips and ropes that were not afraid to use them on black people. And to make matters worse, the governor, George Wallace, had been elected by people like this. But they decided to go anyway. On a Sunday in March 1965, about 600 residents of Selma joined arms to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but they never made it that day. They were beaten back by the sheriff's men with water hoses and electric cattle probes and tear gas and attack dogs. The pictures were in the newspaper and on television all over the world. Martin Luther King would not let them give up, though. He and his helpers began to make phone calls. The word went out across the country, "Come to Selma," and thousands of people heard the word. Women and men, young and old, of all colors and all faiths, had responded to Dr. King's call. About 450 white clergy came, including many Unitarian Universalist ministers. This time, there were 2,000 people ready to march across the bridge toward Montgomery. Although the sheriff's men allowed them access, Dr. King turned the march around and led everyone back to the church in Selma. He knew that more people were on their way to help, and he wanted more time to try to get a permit for the march through the courts. That evening, a group of Unitarian Universalist ministers went out to eat, and then they were beaten by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Reverend James Reeve died of his injuries 2 days later. In the days following Reeve's death, President Lyndon Johnson declared his support of the Voting Rights Bill and vowed that the marchers would be protected. And he declared that we shall overcome. On Sunday, March 21st, Dr. King led the third march to Montgomery. And this time, more than 3,000 people gathered at the church. And this time, they got past the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and they walked along the highway. Their numbers kept increasing until there were 25,000 people by the time they arrived in Montgomery. Just at dawn, there was an amazing sight. The marchers from Selma appeared. They were coming over the hill just as the sun was rising behind them, and they were walking six across with their arms linked, and they were singing, "We shall overcome." And Dr. King spoke to the crowd and to the world, saying that it was time to make real the promise of democracy. And then that August of that year, the Voting Rights Bill became the law. And soon after, 9,000 citizens of Selma, Alabama, 9,000 black citizens, registered to vote. Now, what happened in Selma 50 years ago this month went a long way to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice, but we still have a long way to go.
To lead us into a time of silence, meditation, and prayer, a poem from Marvin K. White, who is a young African-American poet who recently was awarded the Lambda Literary Award. This is his poem, Wiki Prayer, a How-To. Pray as if you are that black boy. Pray as if you are the bullet. Pray as if you are tomorrow waiting on him. Pray as if you are that black boy's mama. Then pray as if you are the whiteness. Pray as if you are the witness. Pray as if you are the curtain through which the killing is witnessed. Pray as if you are the ground that he fell on. Pray as if you are the blood trying to get away. Then pray as if you are daylight savings time. Pray as if you get to break the news to his son. Pray as if you got to watch the news break. Pray as if you are the scripture that speaks healing. Pray as if you can hear black boys crying, even when they're not. Then pray as if you know that even God doesn't know what to say to this. Pray as if You know, people think praying people are right up there with looters. Pray as if you're listening for justice. Pray as if you can't hear none. Pray as if you're black and thinking locked up is better than jaywalking. Then pray that no lies about black boys get past you. Pray as if you are a funeral service. Pray as if you are the money for a spray. Pray as if you meet a florist that hates funerals. Pray as if you know quiet hours can't keep you quiet much longer. Then pray that the cops don't say that they thought your clasped hands were a gun. For all of us, whether we are the system that created the bullet or the soul that the bullet found, help and hope. The sun rose this morning bright and the air is a little warmer. In our corner of the world, we're turning slowly, slowly towards spring. The piles of snow and ice are beginning to melt, saturating the ground, which will soon spring forth delicate crocuses to tell us it's true. The earth will awaken again. Spirit of life and of love, let the lessons of the earth inspire us. Let the light of love and the fire of commitment and the warmth of community slowly, slowly melt the defenses we have built around our own hearts. Let them soak into our soul and awaken in us the life that longs to live in us, a life of justice, a life of freedom, a life of connection, a life of compassion, a life of community. Let the earth be our teacher, and let us be a willing student, eager to learn, eager to open, eager to bless the world. Amen.
Several weeks ago, on the Monday morning after the Academy Awards, Christy Capel, a Cleveland news anchor, made significant waves in the media world by using an old derogatory term for African Americans. Whether she did or did not know the definition of the word is not the message or the point. I felt sad and angry and all kinds of conflicted because I knew exactly what it meant. I heard it in my home as a child and a teenager. My father was, and perhaps still is, a racist. When he wasn't calling African Americans Negro or colored long after it was acceptable to do so, he called them the J word. If you're confused or are not sure what I'm referring to, I will tell you only that it rhymes with the word Kickapoo, and I can explain it to you later. Truth be told, he was an equal opportunity bigot and had choice words for Jews, any non-Roman Catholics, Puerto Ricans, Cape Verdeans, Portuguese immigrants from the Azores in our city, the Kennedys, and my two Polish uncles. Many of his views would make Archie Bunker or perhaps Pat Robertson seem quite rational and maybe even just a little bit liberal. What little I heard and learned of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement was through his distorted lens and very loud voice, which is to say, it was the J. Edgar Hoover version of Martin Luther King Jr. Subversion, philandering, anti-Americanism, and civil uprising. Forgive my language, but he was convinced the Negroes were out to take over the United States. On a level I still do not understand, I simply knew at the center of my being that his view was not the whole story. It did not ring true to either my mind or my heart. But since there was simply no discussing it, and after being shouted down on more than one occasion, I gave up trying. But once I was out on my own and away from the prejudicial, toxic environment of my childhood home, I listened to that small, still voice inside of me. I began to read, study, understand more of the life, the times, and the truths about the civil rights movement and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who I know was not a saint, but certainly not the sinner I was told he was. I admire the man. He was called by his inner voice and by his God to lead, and he listened. From Selma to Montgomery 50 years ago, he led. His legacy and unfulfilled vision of beloved community lead us still. Someday, Martin, someday.
I have a clip I'd like to share with you in case you didn't stay up to watch the Oscars or stay up late enough to hear this speech or see it posted the next day on Facebook. This is the acceptance speech for the award for Best Original Song. It was awarded to Common and John Legend for the song Glory for the movie Selma.
And performed Glory on the same bridge that Dr. King and the people of the Civil Rights Movement marched on 50 years ago. This bridge was once a landmark of a divided nation, but now is a symbol for change. The spirit of this bridge transcends race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, and social status. The spirit of this bridge connects the kid from the south side of Chicago, dreaming of a better life, to those in France standing up for their freedom of expression, to the people in Hong Kong protesting for democracy. This bridge was built on hope, welded with compassion, and elevated by love for all human beings. Thank you. Nina Simone said, "It's an artist's duty to reflect the times in which we live." We wrote this song for a film that was based on events that were 50 years ago, but we say that Selma is now because the struggle for justice is right now. We know that the Voting Rights Act that they fought for 50 years ago is being compromised right now in this country today. We know that right now, the struggle for freedom and justice is real. We live in the most incarcerated country in the world. There are more black men under correctional control today than were under slavery in 1850. When people are marching with our song, we want to tell you we are with you, we see you, we love you, and march on. God bless you.
So if you didn't see Selma yet, you can go online and find the Oscars performance of the song Glory, which was just an incredible performance, and I encourage you to check it out. Selma is now. That's what Common and John Legend had to say at the Oscars, and it's what all sorts of people have been saying as our nation prepares to mark the 50th anniversary of the tragic and transformative events that unfolded there in 1965. Politicians, activists, and scholars, and journalists, and countless religious leaders are all making the case this weekend. The work of Selma isn't done. The work of Selma isn't done because voting rights are still being contested. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court took the most important teeth out of the Voting Rights Act. They said that those states with a history of voter disenfranchisement did no longer needed to get federal approval before making significant voter changes, voting procedure changes, because that law was outdated. They said that Congress should create new legislation which speaks to current conditions, but as of yet, 2 years later, Congress has failed to act. Lack of political will. Meanwhile, several states have instituted new restrictive voter identification requirements which have been widely reported to decrease voter turnout amongst people who are poor, the elderly, and people of color. Selma is now. The work of Selma isn't done because systemic institutionalized racism persists. This week, the Department of Justice released their civil rights investigation report about the city of Ferguson, Missouri. Their report is scathing. It reveals that both the police department and the court system was involved in violating the constitutional rights of African Americans on a repeated and consistent basis. The report details terrible racist jokes circulated amongst police and court officers, and not just entry-level officers, but also supervisors. Racial epithets leveled against community members by police during traffic stops, stopping and holding people without probable cause, excessive use of force, including bites by police canines, and clear attempts to increase city revenues by levying unconstitutional fines and fees on people for minor offenses. The details from Ferguson are on our minds now, but this isn't just a Ferguson, Missouri problem. Several other cities, including Newark, New Jersey, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, are currently being investigated or are currently working with the Department of Justice on correction plans because of similar patterns found in the police forces in their cities. Selma is now. Of course, the problems aren't the same from place to place around the country. Some police departments work hard to ensure that their officers respect the communities they serve. And in some cities, people of color have been elected to important public positions. Take Selma, for example. Today, Selma is served primarily by black public officials. And still, racial inequality persists in Selma. Why is that? Well, part of the problem is that we can't solve racism simply by having more people of color in political positions. In Selma, the economy collapsed. Persistent unemployment, aging infrastructure, underfunded and segregated schools, alongside the maintenance of a wealthy white elite that owns the only segregated country club in Selma and operates private schools which only educate white children, are part of the barriers to progress. This pattern, too, is not simply local. According to recent research by the Pew Research Center, the wealth gap in this country has continued to widen in recent years. In 2013, white households in the United States held 10 times the wealth of Latino, Latina, and Hispanic households, and 13 times the wealth of African-American households. Selma is now. There was another widely reported Ohan speech at the Oscars that merits our attention this morning. Patricia Arquette received the award for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in Boyhood, and she used her acceptance speech to talk about the wage gap between men and women. Her speech was clear and passionate in her call for wage equality, and she was widely applauded, both by the people in the audience and those who heard it the next day on the news. But then we found out that when she went backstage and was further questioned by reporters, she went on to say that it was time for women and men and, quote, all the gay people and all the people of color that we've all fought for to fight for us now. Of course, the reality is that wage inequality affects women of color even more profoundly than it affects white women. White women, on average, earn 78 cents for every dollar that men earn, while African American and Latina women earn, on average, 64 and 56 cents, respectively, for every dollar that men earn. So we can say that Arquette's words were just a moment of verbal fumbling, and who among us hasn't fumbled our words and wished that we could take it back and say a little more clearly what we meant? And that may be true in her case, and I don't mean to point criticism. What I do mean to say is what she actually said reveals a big part of the problem. We cannot afford to pit injustices one against the other. They're all connected. And that's why I loved Common's Oscar's acceptance speech. He made the connections. Selma is now because the injustices that burden the lives of people of color are connected to all the other injustices that burden the lives of people who are marginalized in this society. Racism is connected to economic injustice, which is connected to sexism, which is connected to violence against women and GLBT people, which is connected to discrimination against people with disabilities, and the list goes on and on. Oppression against one group of people is connected to the oppression experienced by another group of people. There's a really fancy word that social justice scholars and activists use to name the fact of those connections. It's called intersectionality, and you can find long academic treatises on intersectionality. What it means in practice is that we just can't afford to be divided. We can't afford to pick one form of oppression and ignore all the rest. It's all connected, just like we are all connected. Liberation for one person or one group isn't enough. We have to be in solidarity and working toward collective liberation. Each generation has the task anew, for oppression appears to be just as much a part of the human condition as is the capacity for love. There's a retired Unitarian Universalist minister who writes an awesome blog called The Lively Tradition, and he's a theologian by nature, and he wrote a blog post recently about how he feels that oppression is nothing new. In every generation, we notice the oppression in our midst, we hope, and we work against it. But it's just as much a part of the human condition as the capacity for love. Our capacity to unite and our capacity to divide is part of the human heart. And so the question is, how will we in every generation work to unite? 50 years ago, many Unitarian Universalists heeded the call to go to Selma. And this weekend, so many more are in Selma commemorating that historic event and reflecting on where we are led now. And I'm really happy to say that a member of our congregation, Lee Brooker, is there representing us this weekend. Our response, the Unitarian Universalist response in Selma, is a proud chapter for us. But it couldn't have been predicted. Several of us have been reading Mark Morrison Reed's book, The Selma Awakening, and he makes plain that Unitarians and Universalists, and that eventually Unitarian Universalists, have long held life-affirming values. Back before we had the language of our current first principle, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person, the language of our predecessors was an affirmation of the supreme worth of every human personality. That's how they talked about that principle. And yet, he explains, for a long time, there was a gap between our values and our practice. Of course, there were always leaders, exemplars, and wayfinders. There were Unitarian Universalist visionaries working for abolition, women's rights, children's rights, prisoners' rights, the rights of the mentally ill, peace, healthcare, education, and in just about every major social justice movement from the mid-19th century on. However, those leaders, visionaries, and wayfinders were not the majority. They were not the average Unitarian or Universalist. And the leadership of the visionaries was countered by the leadership of those who we would now say were standing on the wrong side of history, of love, and of justice. The inconsistencies between the values we named and the values we practiced weren't confined to the leadership. He also writes about the ways in which daily congregational life, including worship culture, religious education, and church leadership, reflected that gap between values espoused and values in practice. We said we valued Black lives in the 1910s and 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, but there was very little about Black lives being taught in Sunday schools or lifted up in worship or reflected in the work of the boards and committees of the average Unitarian and Universalist church around the country. So it wasn't a foregone conclusion that Unitarian Universalists would respond with such great vigor to the call to go to Selma. Mark Morrison Reed says that the reason it happened as it did was because that moment in history, along with all of the moments of consciousness raising that happened during the Second World War, helped expose that gap, make plain the gap between values espoused and values in practice. And the images on the nightly news brought home to people's attention the dissonance in ways that they no longer could tolerate. So they decided to go to Selma. They decided to align their lives with their beliefs, and they went despite the risk. Along with so many African-American civil rights activists, two Unitarian Universalists were killed during their witness in Selma. We hear often about the Reverend James Reeb, the Unitarian minister who was killed. Karen mentioned in her story this morning. Viola Luyuzo was a member of the Unitarian Universalist congregation in Detroit, a mother of five who felt that she simply had to go. And she too was killed in Selma, driving a shuttle of people from Montgomery back to Selma. Those who returned from Selma were transformed by their experience. They were changed by all that they had heard and seen and felt. And they went home speaking of the experience as an experience of wholeness, with an urgent need to devote themselves toward the pursuit of more wholeness in our fractured world. Here we are, 50 years later this weekend, and the struggle continues. Yesterday, Reverend William J. Barber, who is the leader of North Carolina's mass moral movement, he spoke to those assembled in Selma. He's a man who embraces intersectionality, though he gives it his own name. He calls it fusion justice. By that, he means that we all need to work together in the struggle for justice. One oppression is connected to another, and we can't leave anyone behind. He says he's leading a movement that isn't about left or right or Democrat or Republican. He says it's about morality. That's why it's called the moral movement. He says that this is a time in which the work of love and justice must be framed in moral terms. If we don't have voting rights and access to health care and quality education and adequate food and shelter or civil rights protection for all people, then who are we going to leave out? That's the moral question, he says. And the only moral answer is nobody. We're not going to leave anybody out. That's what Unitarian Universalists say matter to us. We care about the worth and dignity of all people and about justice and equity in our public lives and about the values of the democratic process. And so it seems obvious that the work of justice is our collective work. It's not enough to simply say what we affirm. To be whole, we have to find a way to put our values into practice. That's the lesson that history teaches us. Those who have taken that step before us say that it was worth the risk. They helped to change the world, yes, but they also were changed themselves in powerful and profound ways that made their lives better, more meaningful, and more whole. So part of what Morrison Reed concludes in his book is that people can't really think themselves into this kind of transformation that he's talking about. For this kind of transformation, we need to not only think, but also feel and act. So on this 50th anniversary of Selma, if you were to choose just one action, I'd encourage you to learn more about the systemic racism that still persists in this country and the way it's connected to everything else. So read about the findings in the Department of Justice report from Ferguson, read those racist jokes, and see how you feel when you do. Or if you already read the report, you can watch the video of Reverend Barber's speech, and I'll include the link to the video in the e-news later this week. Watch that video and notice how you feel. And then consider whether there is a way that we can help to create change. What can we, this church, do to be a part of the moral movement for justice? How can this Unitarian Universalist Church that we are a part of be a more active part of the movement for collective liberation? This morning, I'm lifting up and encouraging us to think outside of the congregation, the ways in which we're connected to the larger world and how we can be of service to the world. That's a really important part of what a church does. And another important part of what a church does is serve those who call this place home, who are a part of this community. And we do that here through the ministries, the programs, and the activities that help make up our collective life. And this month, we're conducting our stewardship campaign to invite you to be a part of supporting our programs and our ministries. So I want you to know that I have made my pledge of support. I've pledged 5% of my income to this congregation because I believe in the work that we do, not only for us, but I believe in the work that we do that reaches out beyond us. And I hope that you will consider, if you haven't yet made your pledge, how you might support that work too. We have gathered in dedication to the proposition that beneath all of our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth, and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.
Amen.